7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, in the first hour of the program, we have a conversation that we recorded just a couple of weeks ago with a British anthropologist named Piers Vitebsky. He's author of a book entitled The Reindeer People, and it's an account of his experiences over the past couple of decades studying, living with, getting to know a group of nomadic reindeer herders who live in northeast Siberia. It is a story of a very unique relationship between humans and animals, a relationship that's made it possible for these people to survive in one of the harshest climates on Earth. As you listen to the program, do keep in mind that this show was pre-recorded, so in this hour of Focus 580, we will not take your calls. Dr. Vitebsky, hello.
Hi.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, that's a pleasure.
We certainly appreciate it.
Thanks for inviting me.
I thought the place to start would be to have you talk a little bit about the environment of northeast Siberia. I'm sure people will not be surprised to hear that it's cold, at least in wintertime it's cold.
Yeah.
And they might be surprised to hear that, in fact, in summer it can also be warm.
Yeah.
Tell us about the place. What's it like?
Northeast Siberia is mostly very mountainous. So all the climate effects you get of being in the far north are magnified and made more dramatic by those mountains. So the ground is frozen for 6 or 8 months of the winter, and the summer is short. So it can be surprisingly hot. It can reach maybe 30 degrees centigrade, which actually the reindeer find hard to endure. But that's a short space of time for just a few weeks, and then by late August, early September, the snowstorms are starting again. And by November or December, all the water's frozen solid.
This seems to be a place where they experience some of the greatest extremes in climate. It can be as warm as, well, it can be here in the summertime, and much, much colder. I'm not sure that there's any place else in on the Earth that has a swing as wide as that.
I believe so. I believe it is the highest swing on the surface of the Earth. The temperatures go down to about minus 70 centigrade. That's minus 96 Fahrenheit in winter. So the difference is as great as between the freezing and boiling point of water.
How long have people been living in this region?
We don't know, but archaeologists suggest many thousands of years, maybe 10,000 or more.
And the people who lived there originated in northern China and then spread out from there to this very large and rather harsh region?
Yes, this particular group did. It seems that all the groups of people up there originated further south. And one theory is that they were pushed northwards by other populations expanding. And as they moved further north, they developed all sorts of imaginative ways of adapting to the environment.
Well, clearly here, the key thing is the association between the people and the animals, between the people and the reindeer. And I'm assuming that the reindeer could get along just fine without the people, but that the reverse would not be true.
That is absolutely true. But the way the people present it, interestingly, they make it seem as though the reindeer actually asked humans to domesticate them. There's a legend about the origin of the first reindeer. And the legend says that a man was walking through the forest, and in a crack in the trunk of a larch tree, he saw the head of a baby calf peeping out. And this baby calf was trying to be born out of this larch tree and was unable to struggle out. So the human helped it very gently, very tenderly. He coaxed this calf out of this cleft in the tree. And later on, the calf asked humans to continue protecting it and its descendants from the attacks of wolves and other predators. So it's a kind of social contract presented in this legend in which both sides need each other.
It's interesting that while we have here in North America, in Canada and Alaska, we have these animals, and here we call them caribou. And the people there traditionally have hunted them. They never domesticated them. It's interesting that here, these people, the people that we're talking about, did indeed domesticate. And one might want to put that in quotes because I'm not sure whether they are indeed truly domesticated. But that they did this, they established this relationship with the animals, and a long time ago.
It's a big mystery in prehistory. It seems to have happened 2,000 or 3,000 years ago in South Siberia and North Mongolia. And I suppose you do have to call it true domestication because these herds breed and multiply and are managed under human control. And especially because humans saddle the reindeer and ride them and train them and harness them to sledges. So I would definitely call that domestication. Mm. And it was that which enabled humans to spread over the whole of North Asia and Siberia, because otherwise this landscape would be quite impenetrable.
And there are also, in some of these same areas, there are herds of wild reindeer as well?
Yes. The wild reindeer have never disappeared. And it seems that the reindeer might be the only species of animal that has ever been domesticated in order to ride around on it to hunt its wild cousins.
And do the domesticated, other than in that kind of way, are there any other ways, given that there is this overlap, that the domesticated reindeer and the wild reindeer interact?
They interact in a very interesting way. If you look at the distribution map right across the whole of Asia and Europe, you can see there's a kind of inverse relationship. Where the domestic reindeer flourish, the wild ones diminish or disappear. And where the wild ones flourish, that's exactly where there aren't domestic herds. So obviously they compete for the same niche, ecological niche in the ecosystem. And the wild ones are much tougher, of course. So in some areas where there are huge migrating wild herds, they can sweep away a domestic herd, which is never seen again. And the domestic ones are more likely to die sooner from disease or falling prey to wolves.
I'm not sure how much people who are listening to us would know about reindeer. I suppose it's actually possible that people will have seen some of them. And, of course, there's the association between the reindeer and St. Nicholas. Talk a little bit more about these animals, and in particular, the fact and that they are magnificently adapted to being able to live in this extremely harsh climate.
Well, firstly, reindeer are the most gregarious of all the deer family. They actually like to cluster in huge herds. And their adaptation to cold seems almost total. They don't need a den in winter. And they have this extraordinary fur in which each hair is hollow and filled with air. So that provides insulation against the cold and buoyancy when it swims across the icy water. And even the nostrils inside are convoluted in an extraordinary way so that the animal loses very little heat from breathing. So it is one of the most phenomenally well-adapted creatures to cold. And of all the very large prehistoric mammals that roamed the north of the American continent and the European and Asian continent at the time of the Ice Age, this is the only one which actually survives in large numbers.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Piers Vitebsky. He is the head of anthropology and Russian Northern Studies at the Scott Polar Research Institute at University of Cambridge, and has been studying the people that we're talking about, nomadic reindeer herdsmen in the Siberian Arctic, since 1988. He has made a number of documentaries, some of which have been shown on the National Geographic Channel. And he is the author of a book, if you'd like to read more, and it is a fascinating book. It's titled The Reindeer People, Living with Animals and Spirits in Siberia. Houghton Mifflin is the publisher. And this morning's interview is being recorded, so that means in this part of Focus 580, we're not taking listener phone calls. I know that you, before doing the work that you did with the Evenu people in Siberia, you also did some work in India, and here that we were talking earlier about extremes of conditions. I'd say that's a fairly extreme sort of shift between India and Siberia. What was it about these people that interested you?
It was shamanism. That's a kind of religion where people believe that all the phenomena of the landscape around us, the trees, the rocks, the rivers, the lakes, have some kind of life and consciousness of their own, and that humans can communicate with these forms of consciousness, or spirits, as we call them. So I was always fascinated by that kind of religion. So I went to this Aboriginal jungle tribe in India who had this system. And later on, as soon as the Soviet Union started opening a little bit and there was a slight chink in the mid-80s, I got in there as quickly as I could.
And the word shaman, do I have this right that it actually comes from from these people?
That's right. And from there, it's been taken and used in comparative religion for similar kinds of religions all over the world.
You, as I understand, you were the first Westerner since the Russian Revolution to do what you did, to live over a long period of time, on and off over decades, with an indigenous group of people. And I'm sure that at the beginning, that it was difficult to get permission from the government. And this, we're going back here to the time when the Soviet Union still existed. I'm sure that it was difficult for you to get permission from the Soviet authorities to do this at all.
Yes, it was. In the mid-80s, I suppose I would say it's the only time in my life when I've been in the right place at the right time. And suddenly, there seemed to be no rules actually preventing you from going to these long closed areas. But that wasn't the same as actually getting there. So I started in Leningrad, as it was called then, that's St. Petersburg. And I joined a research institute there for several months and started exploring the possibilities. It took a further 2 years before I was given permission to get to Siberia, to a major city there. And once I got to the city, the question was then how to get out of the city several hundred miles away into the mountains where the nomads lived. And once I reached this nomadic village, I was presented with a problem which I really hadn't anticipated, which was there was no transport from the village out to the nomads. So each of these obstacles, you could say, was a further kind of test and a further kind of excitement, too. Mm. As you overcome each of them. And in the end, when I finally got out to the nomadic camp, the people were extremely friendly. And I gradually settled in, and it became part of my life, as you say, for decades.
Were the Soviet authorities particularly concerned about what it was that you might learn and then ultimately might say about these people? As far as they were concerned, was this kind of a public relations sort of an issue?
I think at that time, in the mid and late 80s, the Soviet Union was very split between that and its opposite, which is they were also trying to become very open. So in one sense, they wanted people to come and see what was going on. But in another sense, old habits and old structures were very much in place and very rigid. So when I got to the village itself, it turned out that this split was reproduced even within the community. So the director of the state farm was very anxious that I shouldn't find anything out. And some of his opponents were very anxious to tell me all the things that he was trying to conceal. Hmm. So as an anthropologist, you have to negotiate between these things and take advantage of what you can.
And certainly the great challenge, I'm sure, of any anthropologist doing field work is you're coming into a community that you don't know well, maybe not at all. They don't know you. Initially, I think you spoke Russian with them, so it took a little time for you to learn their language. And the great challenge is for people to accept you well enough so that they'll start to let you into their lives and to tell you about what it is they think and what they believe and what they do every day. And that's not always going to be an easy thing.
No. And the first friends you make, of course, pass you on to their friends. But at the same time, you also inherit their enemies. And there's nobody who's active in a small community who hasn't got enemies as well as friends.
Everybody knows in a small town, everybody knows everybody else. Everybody knows everybody else's business. Yes, and I'm sure that what might seem to be petty squabbles could loom very large if you're talking about a small place and a small group of people who are in each other's faces and in each other's businesses every day.
Especially when there's so much at stake, because this was one of the great turning points of history, of world history as well as just local history in the Soviet Union. So in the course, for example, of the 1 year of 1990, I followed what happened to three different families, and they went to completely different destinies. One family was rewarded, another was completely destroyed.
This is one of the interesting parts of the story, and that is how it is that these people adapted or didn't adapt to changing circumstances, and how it is that the government tried to change the way that they live. Here, obviously, we're talking about people who were nomadic the government seemed to think that some aspects of the way they lived their lives were backward and it would be good for them to live in a more modern way, to live like other people. But that seems to go completely against their traditional culture, their way of living, their relationship with the animals. You can't really take nomads and say, well, from now on, you're going to live in a town, because it's so foreign to the way that they had been living for a very long time.
It's foreign to their way of living and their mentality, but also it doesn't really work in terms of their productive economy. The problem is reindeer have to migrate huge distances, hundreds of miles every year, because the vegetation is so thin and grows so slowly in that climate that you can't allow the animals to overgraze any spot. So that means herders have to go with them, guiding them, steering them across this landscape. And until the Soviet regime came along, whole families would move together with their animals, and so that they would have a normal social life. What the Soviets did is they decided, well, nomadism as a way of life is primitive and backward, but nomadism as a form of productive, industrialized economy is fine. But for that, we only need the men to do the herding. So we'll pull the women and children into villages. We'll establish a new concept of village and invent jobs for the women, create schools for the children, and keep them in the village. But of course, what they didn't anticipate is that that would break up the family completely, and so that what you have out on the landscape is men moving around with the herds who know they're never, ever going to live with their wives or children. And that led to high rates of depression and alcoholism and suicide. And in the end, young men are withdrawing from this occupation altogether.
That, I guess that raises the question of what's the future for these people and their what has been their traditional way of life. Does it indeed have a future as long as the government continues to take that kind of attitude towards their life and how it is that they, the government, think that the people should live?
Well, even if the government adapts, a situation has now been set up. These people have quite a cosmopolitan mentality. They read newspapers, they listen to the radio. They have certain expectations. And for a while, the government created quite a high level of material comfort because they provided helicopters, which you could just radio for and they would turn up, bring you supplies. Now all of that has disappeared. The state can't afford to run a fleet of helicopter taxis. So people are being thrown back on subsistence again. So some people are going back to the land, the people who like it, the people who think it's beautiful and exciting and who know how to live on the land. And then there are other people who I think will probably just migrate to the cities and disappear. So it's a moment of great uncertainty and great flux.
It seems also that there has been, over time, a kind of a change in the attitude of the government towards the people and how their lives are organized, in the sense that it seems that there was a time when the Soviets were looking at these people and their animals as a kind of collective farm, it different only in the sense that it didn't stay in one place, that was the model for a while, and that then they moved to a more kind of capitalist entrepreneur model, at least in the sense that they moved from a point where I'm sure that the idea was that the herd belonged to everybody, to the point where it was suddenly okay for individuals to own individual animals. They got this idea of private property into the whole business.
Yeah.
How did that sort of swing between or transition between these two different kind of models, was that difficult for people? Was that a difficult adjustment, or was it not that much different as far as they were concerned?
The way I heard it from them was that the collectivization in the 30s was very difficult because people need a large number of reindeer just to ride around on the landscape. Otherwise, you're completely immobilized. So when all the reindeer were confiscated and put into collective herds, people experienced that as very harsh. When it became possible to own private reindeer in the late 1980s, most people welcomed this. But of course, what they didn't realize is that the breakup of the state farm meant the breakup of a whole support infrastructure as well. So that actually nobody can survive as a single entrepreneur without some level of collective support. So this is what they're trying to work out now. And It should be said that some aspects of the Soviet policy were really intended to be benign. There was some idealism, and these Soviet authorities were trying to make these people's lives better. But the sad thing is that they didn't really listen to what the people themselves had to say.
I'd like to have you talk a little bit more about the way that the people use the animals and what they represent in their life, because, as you have said, they use them for transport, but they also use all the other parts of the animals. They do eat them. They use the milk. They use the hide. I'm sure it's like it is as it is with any other group of people that depend on an animal for their livelihood. They use every single part that they possibly can use. That's an important resource. What in how many ways do they use the animal?
I would say it's a total reindeer way of life. So it's not just, of course, it's the meat. There's almost nothing else to eat, because we're in an environment where you can't grow crops. And the fur, because in the winter you can't stay alive unless you're wrapped up in reindeer fur. So it's an extraordinary thing. When you see a human riding on a reindeer in the winter, it's like an antlered centaur. You can't tell where the human ends and the reindeer begins, really. And even the reindeer fur they wear smells of reindeer. It's a total reindeer experience. And this extends to their idea of the reindeer's soul, we could say. So they have this extraordinary system that each person has a reindeer animal double, you could say, a consecrated reindeer, which represents you. And this is a special kind of reindeer. You don't ride it, you don't eat it, but you look after it very carefully, and it represents you. So when you're threatened by some kind of danger, and this is a very dangerous landscape with a lot of deaths, when you're threatened by some kind of danger, your reindeer stands in front of you and takes the blow for you. So if your consecrated reindeer suddenly dies, you know that it's protected you from some harm, even if you may never know what that harm was. So they have this idea that the reindeer offers itself as a kind of living sacrifice to defend you.
I think it's fascinating, this connection that people have with the animals that is so varied, and it's pragmatic and it's mystical both. And it seems that sort of mystical connection that people feel with these animals goes back a very long time. It may indeed go all the way back to this point where, and I guess nobody knows exactly when that was, but the point where these animals went from being wild to being domesticated.
I think it must be. And you can see this very clearly when you go to a funeral and you see how somebody is buried, which is that you might think that a grave is the one point at which a nomad actually comes to rest and stops migrating. But it really isn't so, because on the grave, all sorts of offerings are given, and all these offerings are smashed. So when you visit a recent grave, you're standing in an eerie silence of shattered objects, all of which have been killed so that they can pass on into the next world. So lying around, there are smashed vodka bottles, snapped cigarettes, broken sledges. A child's grave will have ripped dolls and teddy bears on it. And all of these things are being sucked through the grave as a kind of portal into the next world. And then on top of it all, the most important thing is the sacrificed reindeer. Every bone has to be preserved and kept. Nothing must be lost. The skin is left hanging up above the grave, with its legs flopping down like an empty sack from which everything, the meat, the bones, the soul, has been sucked out. And the point of all this is that these things are all following the dead person onwards on an onward migration in the next world, round a further succession of campsites which will never end. And the reason why all the bones of the reindeer must be collected is the person is going to ride on that reindeer in the next world. So if even one bone is missing, the reindeer will be lame and the person will be immobilized.
We are about at the midpoint of this conversation here in this hour of Focus 580, and for anyone who has just tuned in, I would like to introduce again our guest. Piers Vitebsky is an anthropologist. He's done field work among shamans and shift cultivators in tribal India, that going back to the mid-70s. A little bit more recently, but for a long time, over the past couple of decades, he has worked among nomadic reindeer herdsmen in the Siberian Arctic, that since the 80s. He has done a number of documentaries, some of which have been shown one on the National Geographic Channel. The last documentary was on Arctic aviators. And the book, if you'd like to read it, the book that I mentioned a little bit earlier, which is about the people of Siberia that he lived with and got to know. The book is titled The Reindeer People, Living with Animals and Spirits in Siberia. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin. Pierce Vitebsky is head of anthropology and Russian Northern Studies at the Scott Polar Research Institute at University of Cambridge, and is spending a little bit of time here in the United States to talk about it. And we're pleased that he could give us some of his time. We are recording this interview this morning, so that means that today, at least in this hour of focus, we're not taking phone calls from people who are listening. One of the things that I'm sure that people think about when they think about reindeer, at least people who are listening to us, I'm sure, is the, as I said before, is the association with Santa Claus or St. Nicholas or whatever you want to call this fellow who has the sled drawn by the reindeer and flies through the air. And one of the interesting things about these people is that they have in their culture this tradition of thinking about reindeer being able to fly. And that's something that they also have been talking about. It's been part of their way of thinking for a very long time.
That's right. If you walk across this landscape, the going is very slow and painful. As soon as you ride on the back of a reindeer or on a sledge harnessed behind a reindeer, you really skim at a fantastic speed. And you do begin to get the impression that you're taking off and flying. I can see how these ideas grew. But it's not only in that direct experience. You can see that they've built this up into a whole imagery. There are prehistoric stones, which seem to be gravestones or memorial stones, dating from 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, which show reindeer with their antlers grown into fantastic wings, stretching all the way back to the tail. And some of these antlers even have birds' heads all over them. And there's obviously an image of flying on these memorial stones. And some of the bodies that have been found associated with them have tattooed reindeer, flying reindeer, on their shoulders. So I think that all of these express ideas about how the reindeer can fly and somehow carry the human soul with it. And I wouldn't have been able to make that connection until I went to these people, and it turned out that among the old people, there were a few people who remembered a ritual from their childhood, which took place every year at midsummer. And in this ritual, each person would, in their ritual performance, ride on the back of a reindeer and fly up to the sun on Midsummer's Day. And there they would receive a blessing from the sun, which would look after them and see them through for the rest of the year. So we can see that the reindeer is a creature, as they say, put on earth in order to insulate us with its fur, nourish us with its meat, its flesh, and exalt us with its soul by lifting us right up to the highest level of the sky. So these are very ancient ideas, much older than the ideas of Santa Claus. Mm. But there does seem to be a connection.
And is this a metaphor? Or is it something more that has a level of reality to it that is greater than that?
It depends how you see a metaphor. I mean, religious ideas are metaphors on one level and are taken very literally on another. But unfortunately, I wasn't able to see this kind of ritual because that's one of the things that the communist regime stamped out. Hmm. All one could do is talk to old people about it. And they said, yes, I remember, I had this feeling, I was born aloft, I became airborne.
My guess would be that those kinds of beliefs and practices might not be all that easy to stamp out completely. Are there any shamans anymore?
Very, very few, because the repression was very thorough. Mm. And the few real old kind of shamans who survived just hung out in the forest in great secret. I have seen a few of these people. I do know some. And they do still occasionally perform. And when they perform, they do indeed. They go into a trance, and they say that their souls are borne aloft, and that they fly up to the 7th or the 12th level of the sky, and there they encounter various spirits. They negotiate with the spirits on behalf of their patients or clients. And gradually they come down to earth again, and they hope that their patients are made better.
The idea, the base, as I understand it, the basic idea of shamanism is this idea that we have, there are two worlds. There are separate worlds. There's the physical world in which we live. There is a spirit world, but that there is some overlap, and that the spirits do involve themselves. Things that we can't see involve themselves in our lives, and so you need someone who can negotiate, who in a sense has a foot in each world.
That's right. I think maybe the best way to see this kind of religion is to say that there's a world of phenomena around us that we can see, and then there's some kind of the essence of these phenomena, which lie behind them. These are what they call the spirits, and these spirits are also causes of things that happen to us. So what we might call the forces of nature are conceptualized by these kinds of people as spirits of nature, which have their own intentions, their own will, which do certain things to us. And therefore, we need somebody like the shaman to go and negotiate with them and make their intentions and wills come out in the way that we want.
While the shamans may be gone, while there are not many or any of them left anymore, does the worldview persist? Do people still think about the way the world works in that same way, or have they also gotten away from that as well?
No, I think some of that persists very much, partly because the world is still very dangerous, this landscape. As I say, many people die, they fall through ice, they get killed by animals, various things happen. So when you perceive the world as potentially dangerous as well as nourishing, you have to have some kind of way of thinking about these dangers and how you deal with them. And what I've noticed is that the shamans were destroyed by the regime, but all the things that people could do for themselves have flourished very much. So people do divination by listening to the crackling of the fire, for example, the campfire. And if you listen attentively, it speaks in a whole language, and it tells you, it warns you of dangers, it tells you if a visitor's coming, it tells you about where the animals are and where you may be able to hunt them or where you shouldn't go. And the other thing they do is they take their dreams very seriously, because they believe that dreams can reveal relationships and causes within human events that we can't perceive in a waking state.
I think that's interesting. I was sitting here thinking that if this was your worldview and that was the way that you thought about the way things worked, and the fact that there were dangers in the world and they had to be negotiated, that if then suddenly the person or the people that you had relied on in the past to help weren't there anymore, I would think that could be sort of frightening and upsetting, because you would suddenly be on your own.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So the bits that you can do for yourself become very important. And people make all sorts of connections. For example, one woman told me, she said, I had this dream in which, when I was a young girl, I was riding up a mountain on a reindeer, and the reindeer got weaker and weaker and finally collapsed and died. And I looked down at it with great sadness. But then I got on a horse, and the horse with great difficulty managed to haul itself up to the top of the mountain. And then she said, it was only years later that I realized this dream was showing me my whole life in advance, because my first husband was a reindeer herder, and he did indeed die. And then my second husband is a horse herder, and this, you can see, this is the horse that carries her up to the top of the mountain. And she said, his health is fragile, but the dream shows me that if I really look after him well, he won't die, he will survive.
One of the things that I read about you is that you're interested in the relationship between psychology and environment, assuming that I have that right. Are there some ways in which you think that for this group of people, the place that they live, the environment, has shaped the way that they think?
Yes, I think very much. One is, as I said, the landscape is dangerous, so you need to be very careful how you tread on it and how you impose yourself on it. A bit like our new Western idea of your carbon footprint. They're very concerned about the kind of footprint they make on the landscape. So you mustn't shout loudly in the forest, you mustn't sing loudly, you mustn't do anything that would offend the spirits of the place. Everywhere you go, everywhere you pitch a tent, you have to feed the fire with the first offering of food and drink before you eat or drink anything yourself, because otherwise that location won't accept you as its guest. So, and generally there's an anxiety about anything that's very sudden. So if you meet somebody in the forest, you might have been alone for a month and you come across somebody, you don't immediately call to them. And if you have news, you don't immediately tell them what the news is. You edge in very, very gently so as to prevent any kind of sense of shock. And I notice that when they leave a place, these are nomads, so every few days they move on, they pull their tent up and migrate another few miles. They never look back at the site because that would create a sense of sundering from the previous site. What you have to do is make everything feel smooth and gradual, so you just keep moving ever onwards.
It's interesting that makes me think that I suppose that one might think of nomads as a people who don't live anywhere. But when you put it that way, it makes it sound like, in fact, nomads are people. It's not that they don't live anywhere. It's that they live everywhere.
Absolutely. And nomads don't wander. They go around in fixed cycles, which are repetitive each year. And so they know every one of these locations. But each location they come to, they last saw a year ago. So you're absolutely right. They live everywhere around that circuit. And I noticed in their religious sensibility, there's an interesting difference from the kind of religions we're used to, where you have a fixed church or a temple, which is a sacred site that you go to visit. And when you go to it, you get drawn further and further in till you reach the most sacred spot, like the altar in a church. But here you've got no spot that's more sacred than any other. Wherever they go, they pitch their tent, they light a fire, they feed the spirit of the place through the fire by giving vodka, meat. And just for those few days while they're living there, that is the spiritual center of their universe. That is the focal point of sacredness. But then they'll leave, and that site will just lie dormant for another year until they come back again.
We are at the point where we have maybe about 15 minutes left in this part of the show. I just would like to again introduce our guest, Piers Vitebsky. He is head of anthropology and Russian Northern Studies at the Scott Polar Research Institute, which is at University of Cambridge, and over the last couple of decades has spent quite a lot of time living with and getting to know nomadic reindeer herdsmen in the Siberian Arctic, and has written a book about these people and his experiences. It's titled The Reindeer People, Living with Animals and Spirits in Siberia. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. You, I'm sure, can find it in the bookstore now, and it is a very interesting story. And I'll just again mention to people who are listening that we are recording the interview today, and so that means in this part of the show we are not taking phone calls. Not only did you live with these people and get to know them, your family did as well.
Yes. That was many years after I'd started living there, because it's quite a delicate business bringing two parts of your life together. And I wanted to be sure, really, that each side was prepared for the encounter.
So your wife and children went and also spent some time with these people. How did they find this experience? What was it like for them?
I think each one of them responded in their own way. So my wife found the landscape beautiful, but rather menacing, and as an adult, it was much more difficult for her to work out what her position should be among the women. For my son and daughter, it was easier, really, because they didn't have that kind of adult responsibility, and they could just roam this landscape and make friendships with the people and the animals relatively freely. So they found it thrilling.
Hmm. How did the people there, I guess I'm particularly interested in how it is they reacted to or interacted with your children. How they did they in a sense take them in and almost make them one of theirs?
Yes, very much. But a lot depends on individuals. So there was a young herder, for example, who took a liking to my son because he saw in him a kind of naughty dissident personality like himself. And then my daughter was always drawing things, so they were fascinated by that because they like drawing and writing themselves. So each side and each person would find whatever they could to make a connection through. So they were trying to diminish the differences.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me the kind of experience that would be ideal for growing future anthropologists. Or either that, or they might say, no, this is actually not something that I would want to do. Do you see some interest in them in that direction?
I think, and this often happens with anthropologists' children, it becomes a formative part of their lives, but it doesn't necessarily turn them towards anthropology, but it leaves them very open to the world in whatever it is they do choose to do.
We talked a little bit earlier. One of the things that you talked about was the fact that the Soviet, going back to the government of the Soviet times and still, that the government had this idea that they wanted these people to live more like other people did. And for that reason, they thought, well, people should live in towns and villages. But they also recognized the fact that their life was based around the animals and that the animals had to move. So they made this strange compromise where they set up towns and the women live in the town and the men stay with the animals because the animals have to move. So the animals move around, the men move around, and that breaks up families and it causes a lot of distress. And for that reason, that then a lot of young men particularly, apparently they decide they don't want that kind of life. And that if that's the kind of thing, that if it continues long enough, these people, they may go off, they may go to the city to live, they will abandon the traditional way of life. It makes you wonder exactly what sort of future there is for these people and the way that they live. And given all that, that kind of change, another thing that I'm interested in is climate, environment change, and what that means for their life. And I'm thinking about the fact that in North America, in the Arctic, we know that there has been a significant change in the climate, which has impacted the environment in some pretty dramatic ways, which also has impacted the indigenous people who have been living there and living in certain ways for a long time. Has there been that kind of parallel sort of thing in Siberia? Has it happened there at all?
Yes, it has. More in South Siberia so far, where the winters are getting much warmer. But people do say that the winters are getting warmer in the far north as well. And at the moment, the direst warnings are for the cities, because the cities are built on permafrost. And if the permafrost starts to melt, then the buildings will capsize and sink into the bog. For nomads who just live in tents and move them around every few days, that particular threat is not so strong. But they are worried about the thinning ice, because the ice gets 6 feet thick in winter for 6 months, and you need to be able to rely on that ice in order to skim in reindeer sledges across huge lakes and frozen gulfs of the sea. So that is one kind of anxiety. And also they think it might change the migratory habits of all the animals they rely on, mm-hmm. not just the reindeer, but other animals that they hunt for food.
How great an area do people and animals move?
Well, this one group of a community of 700 people moves something like an area of 1.1 million hectares. So that is, I'm just trying to work out the figure, 4,300 square miles is the terrain farmed by these few hundred people. And that is just one of the many reindeer herding communities. So we're talking about vast areas. And I calculated that one reindeer needs something like 150 acres of pasture to survive.
Just one reindeer needs 150 acres?
Of pasture. pasture.
Of pasture. That's a lot of territory per animal, particularly when you're thinking about with this, the size of the herds these people have can be in the thousands?
Oh, yes. This group of people has about 20,000 reindeer. And so in the whole of Russia, in the early 90s, there were just over 2 million domestic reindeer. And that's now fallen to about 1 million because of various kinds of political and economic crisis. But that's still a lot of animals, and it requires a lot of land.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, they come into conflict if there are oil or mineral developments or pipelines going over their territory. Then that becomes a serious problem because the reindeer and their herders really can't spare that land.
How do different groups of people work out the business of having also to share the resource of the land?
That's difficult because local communities don't have nearly such a forceful voice as they do in North America. These structures don't exist because in the Soviet system everything was much more centralized. So they're only just beginning to form their pressure groups and find their voices. But sometimes they're becoming very effective.
When you went for the first time, did you have certain kinds of expectations and then find that what you thought you were going to find, what you actually found was very different than what you thought that it was going to be like?
What I found was much more lively and much more fun than I expected, because the Soviet literature was written in a rather gray way, which concealed a lot of the amusement and the irony and the diversity of these people. So when I got there, it turned out they have a fantastic sense of irony, and they were using it all the time as a way of subverting and defeating the system.
Can you give an example, tell a story that illustrates that?
Well, all sorts. For example, they were always making little comments about white colonialism, about the Russians. And I remember one moment, they cut their meat by holding a large piece of meat in their teeth and then cutting it upwards with a knife so that you take into your mouth just the bit you're going to chew and then you're left with this big lump and you keep on cutting a bit off. Well, they have pretty flat noses, so they can use these sharp knives upwards, but I was much more anxious about doing that. And once I was doing this rather gingerly, and my companion said, did you know archaeologists have discovered a tribe of long-nosed Europeans who used to live in this area? And I thought, wow, that's pretty strange, but they read a lot of archaeology and anthropology. Really? I said, what? Oh, yes, he said. But they became extinct because they kept on cutting off their noses every time they... And then he said, it's obvious, isn't it, from Darwin or Lamarck, you've just got to adapt either your nose or your eating habits. And then another herder, the other side of the tent, said, well, that's no guarantee, he said. Mammoths had long noses, and they didn't use knives because they were vegetarians, but they still died out. So they're playing with all these ideas all the time.
One of the things that I'm sure is true that over time and still now, we are the world's in the great variety of indigenous cultures in the world are disappearing. Maybe not that the people literally are disappearing, but the way that they live is disappearing. They're going off to live in cities. They're not speaking their languages anymore. They're not living in the ways that they had. They're kind of becoming like everybody else. What do we lose if we lose these distinct cultures? If we'd get to the point where these folks, they all go to live in cities, they never herd reindeer anymore, what is it that we'd lose?
I think we lose the possibility of seeing the world in other ways, because our own way is only one, or one small cluster of ways of looking at things. And if we allow it to take over and dominate everything, then we may forget that there are other ways and that there are other kinds of wisdom too. But at the same time, I'm not sure that everything is becoming the same, because these people bring with them, if they move to the city, they bring with them their own subtleties, their own insights, and these feed into the general mainstream. You asked earlier about the word shaman, but of course, ideas about shamanism have become quite mainstream in Western cultures as well. So there's a constant movement back and forwards of ideas.
And do you think that, I'm thinking here again about the fact that anthropologists, I think the idea is that you're not supposed to at least actively change things by your presence. And at the same time, I'm sure that that's impossible not to do that. Do you think that there's some way in which your being there and your having lived with these people also changed their lives?
I think it does. And one way that they point out all the time is that it's a way for the outside world to know that they exist. And they see you as a resource, really. And when there are ways in which they can use you for publicity or to defend them from things that the administration is doing that they don't like and so on, then they do try to use you. And as an anthropologist, you do try to speak up for the community you study and have become devoted to.
Well, you know, I think at that we will have to finish up because we've come to the end of the time. The book, for people who are listening, is The Reindeer People, Living with Animals and Spirits in Siberia. It is published by Houghton Mifflin by our guest, Piers Vitebsky. He is head of anthropology and Russian Northern Studies at the Scott Polar Research Institute at University of Cambridge, now spending a little time here in the United States to talk about the book. And Dr. Vitebsky, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And you've been listening to a Focus 580 conversation we recorded just a couple of weeks ago, so that means no calls in that hour. Coming up, though, in the next, we will have two live guests with us here in the studio, and certainly are welcome to call. Scottish folk singer Jean Redpath is here. She's here for a New Year's Eve concert with the Chorale, and also joining us in the next hour will be Julie Beyer. She is the musical director of the Chorale. Otherwise, this week we are in archives, and by the way, past programs of Focus, Afternoon Magazine, all of our local production available on our website. That's WILL.UIUC.EDU. The broadcast made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated, serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. We're going to break for news and update on the markets. Stay tuned.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carl Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farming.